The Morisato children were duly introduced to, and enthralled by, Serge. Then Liza and Azalin came in from the walk they'd taken, and Liza had a joyful reunion with Mary, who'd only seen her eldest sister a couple of times since Liza's return from the Outer Rim. "Is that a tattoo?" asked Mary, tracing the violet lightning bolt on Liza's face. "Not quite," Liza replied. "It's dye. I have to refresh it every couple of weeks or it fades. I do have tattoos, though," she added with a wicked grin. "If you ask me really nicely later, in private, maybe I'll let you see them." Mary laughed, delighted. "God, Mama would have a stroke." She leaned back, placing the back of one hand over her eyes, and gasped in the tone of a woman about to expire. "Oh, oh! My own flesh and blood, marking herself, disfiguring herself, in such a heathen, alien manner. Oh, what would your sainted grandmother, whose name you bear, say at a time like this?" "From what I remember of Grandma," said Liza, "she'd laugh her ass off, then bake a cake. Aside from you and Grandpa, she was the only sane one in our family. That's why I kept her name when I threw away the other ones." Mary nodded, still grinning, and then turned to her sister's golden-eyed companion. "And you must be Azalin?" Azalin nodded. "That's right." "You're Dantrovian." "Uh-huh." "Daddy says Dantrovians are dirty, wanton creatures without even the morals of common alley cats," said Mary bluntly. Then, a moment later, she pursed her lips thoughtfully and added, "But then, Daddy doesn't get laid very often, so I suppose his grapes are pretty sour by now." Azalin goggled at her for a moment, unable to speak, then burst out laughing. "I can tell you hang around with Sylvie, that's for sure," she told the youngest Broadbank when she had enough control to speak again. "You've got a good sense of humor," Mary noted. "That's good. I think you'll need one if you're going to spend much time with the dread pirate Liza." She grinned at Liza again. "So every night when you went to bed, did Captain Arion tell you, 'Good night, Liza. I'll most likely kill you in the morning'?" Liza laughed. "Unfortunately, no. But there were plenty of nights when I thought the work might kill me in the morning." "You promised you'd tell me all about it," Mary reminded her, mock petulantly. "And I will," Liza told her. "Right after lunch. We'll go look at Saturn and I'll tell you the whole story, start to finish. Will that satisfy you, or will we have to be rude and skip lunch so I can get started now?" "No, no," said Mary magnanimously. "I never make anyone skip a meal. It's the first thing you learn if you stay at Bell's." Mary held her sister to her word, though, and once lunch was out of the way, the two of them disappeared for several hours while Liza told her whole story. As such, they missed the rounds of arrivals that kept happening during the afternoon. People kept turning up in ones and twos and threes and more, their vehicles crowding the car park near the front gates, their footprints trampling the path up to the grand entrance. The cloakroom filled with their coats, and still they came, effusively greeted by Keiichi Morisato. The host had vanished into the kitchens, vowing that Bell wasn't going to do everything for once. That left Kay to run the castle's air traffic control system, such as it was. Kay called the duty parking cars, and Keiichi to stand by the door greeting people and taking their coats. Serge was not unduly put out by the ever-growing crowd. After all, he was bred to enjoy crowds. Once, noticing that more than 10 people were standing around in a loose semicircle looking at him, he spontaneously climbed up onto his ball, balancing on all fours and using his tail for a counterweight. Unfortunately, he lacked a full-grown tiger's coordination yet, so he almost immediately tipped over sideways and flumped to the rug. There was a brief, awkward silence until his audience saw that he wasn't hurt. Then they laughed, assuming it was part of the show. Undaunted, he tried twice more, then gave up and started batting the ball around instead. Peril took an interest in that, and despite the fact that the ball was somewhat larger than he was, the gray cat put in a pretty good showing. This attracted Nall, Lesser Mazinger, and Tiny Robo, and before long quite a lively little soccer match was underway. It went on until one of the robots almost knocked over the Christmas tree, at which point the revelers were sternly instructed to take it outside. But the ball didn't roll very well in the snow, so it turned into more of a freestyle scuffle in the side yard. Before long, a number of the children had come out to join them. That eased the congestion inside somewhat, for still they came. Mia Aus's father, Network 23 reporter John Trussell, and his pilot, a sharp redhead who went by the somewhat suspicious name Jungfreud. The Roses, Martin and Aiko, Tom and Danilia Mulcroft-Nierknet, Hansen and Nadia Davian, and some other members of the Challenger command staff, including Klang, Tevek, and Ensign Kirk. Janice Barlow, who had come over from Girado on Challenger but stayed aboard to take care of some paperwork regarding her IPO internship, beamed down with them. A few of the invited had, of course, sent their regrets. One of the more notable absences was Aya Nakajima, who had just finished the 6th Carrier Task Force's post-refit shakedown cruise and cycled back into the Babylon 5 patrol duties to replace Kai Tung's 3rd Task Force, going to the Ards for its own refit. A last-minute attempt to come had run aground on the Earth Alliance's strong diplomatic request that the CFMF please keep its warships and its Nakajimas out of the solar system. Still, between her normal efforts and the added ingenuity of Krontep, Derek Bacon, Jer Johnson, and Michael Garibaldi, B-5 was experiencing a Christmas party to remember. Similarly, Noriko Takaya, Dave Ritchie, Jim Kirk, Jean-Luc Picard, and their various staffs were prevented from accepting their invitations by duties elsewhere. Kay was up in the West Tower, watching the comm panel, when it bleeped for her attention. She'd been expecting it to, since she'd been tracking an incoming blip for the last couple of minutes, and now, as the hailing ship swept in over the bay and banked into a holding circle over the parking area, she got a good look at it through the windows. The new arrival was most definitely a starfighter, but with no discernible lifting surfaces. About the only concession to aerodynamics were two vertical fins, or were they wings, mounted aft, obscuring the oversized engines. It had a blocky, almost chunky look to it, and the slate-gray thermocoat merely added to the surreality. What really caught Kay's attention, though, was the engine note, clearly audible through the tower control room's windows. It wasn't the high-pitched near-whine of conventional fusion thrusters. This craft's engines were throaty in an atmosphere, almost growling. Thankfully, the pilot was keeping it subsonic. The comm crackled to life. "This is WDFX Caliber, requesting permission to land." Kay recognized the voice. "Funny, I thought the Excalibur was a Miranda-class cruiser," she remarked. "You want me to say that the ship shrunk in the wash?" the pilot retorted. "Besides, I like the name, and I didn't want to call it the King Arthur. This is Techie, by the way, and Chip is riding in the back seat." "I could kind of guess," Kay said, amused at Techie's trademark bluntness. "Where's the rest of the family?" "Elana and Reyna are a few minutes behind in the car. I finally got this thing refitted, and I figured this would be a nice shakedown cruise. Anyway, I think I see space enough down there if it's not reserved." "We've got plenty left, Techie. I'm sending you a vector for Area 11 now. Just slide it on in." "Roger that. Techie out." Aboard the old starfighter, Percy Techie Moy turned off the comm, chuckling. "Hey, Dad, weren't we going to test the cloaking device?" Chip asked. "Later, son. Besides, it's not polite to sneak up on your host." "Does that mean you were thinking about it?" Techie spared a glance back. "Rule number one of parties, Chip. Never piss off your host." Not long after that, the Overstreet contingent arrived. The Right Honorable Ambassador Plenipotentiary from the Confederate Freespacers Alliance to the Republic of Zeta Cygni, Admiral Kristen O. Overstreet, retired, thought it was a damn shame Griff didn't have a Chamberlain to announce people this time, because his party would have been a hoot to have announced. As it was, he just resigned himself to go around glad-handing and individually introducing his younger charges. His wife, Professor Washu Hakubi of the new Avalon Institute of Science, certainly needed no introduction, nor did Rihanna and Mail, who were well known to almost all in attendance. His daughter disappeared almost immediately, plunging into the crowd to search for playmates, and apparently ignoring his bellowed instruction to be careful! And he sighed an oppressed sort of sigh. The tiny redhead standing in front of him, very tidy in a little holiday frock, as opposed to the slightly less tiny one in the holly-print lab coat, looked up at him and said, "She's a trial, isn't she?" "Kettle, thou art black," Redneck muttered, then was spared having to answer for real by the appearance of his hostess. "Well, howdy, Redneck," said Kay, shaking his hand. "Professor," she added, greeting Washu as well. Mail and Rihanna had already vanished into the crowd. Rihanna was probably looking for her father, who was on the guest list. In this, she would be frustrated, as he hadn't arrived yet. "Hello, Kay," said the redneck, grinning. "I don't believe you've met Lena Diggers." Kay hunkered down to be at something like eye level with the tiny girl. "I don't believe I have," she said personably. "I'm Kay Morgan. Nice to meet you, Lena." Lena dropped a somewhat haphazard curtsy. She didn't seem unwilling to be properly polite, just sort of inexperienced at it, and said she was pleased to meet Kay, albeit only after demanding, rather bluntly, the location of the food, and receiving a bit of a thump on the head from Washu for her trouble. "Lean is staying with Washu and me while she goes to school in New Avalon," Redneck explained. "She's in the G&T program." Kay, three of whose own children were in the same program, nodded with a knowing smile. "Ah," she said. "Say no more. Hey, Lena, do you like tigers?" Lena looked a trifle confused. "Tigers? Sure," she said, just polite enough not to add the unspoken but obvious, "But what's that got to do with anything?" "Well then, come with me for a minute," Kay went on. "My daughter Caitlin has something you might like to see." And still they came, well past nightfall and into the early evening. More snow began to fall a half hour or so past dark, and as the gathered group got too big for the library, most of it moved to the Great Hall of Castleary. The clan Shannon arrived at 6:45, allowing Tenchi and Ashka to complete the Ragnarok wave. Their elder offspring were unable to attend, but sent their regrets. The canapes started appearing at 7. Utena Tenjo emerged from the kitchen along with them to inform the group that dinner would be ready promptly at 8. Having conveyed the canapes and this message, she didn't return. Aunt Belle had thanked her for her help and informed her flatly that if she didn't get out there and enjoy her evening, Belle would be very disappointed. So Utena meekly took off her apron, hung it up, and stayed out in the Great Hall to enjoy her evening. Immediately she spotted something that made her laugh, getting her off to a good start. Serge had apparently developed a fascination with Skaya's long, mobile tail, and was chasing its constantly moving tip all around as the scrang circulated. Skaya obviously knew about this and was playing along, much to Caitlin's delight. Utena picked up a couple of canapes and a drink, and headed off to see what the others were up to. Skuld scanned the Great Hall with a grin. It looked like the party, as always, was a rousing success. Liza Shustal's transformation had attracted its fair share of attention. The children of the Ragnarok were huddled in a corner plotting some kind of mayhem, and Belle was keeping all and sundry plied with food and drink with the able assistance of her duelist volunteers, Sayanji and Shinohara. Everything looked like Griffin had pulled off the event of the year yet again. Until her gaze fell to one side of the buffet table, where a young woman with a ponytail of dark auburn hair sat with a cup of punch in her hand and no real expression on her face. Skuld frowned. That was Janice Barlow, Griffin's latest IPO recruit. What could possibly be wrong? The Norn grabbed a cup of punch off the nearest tray, leaving Kyuichi Sayanji thrown somewhat off balance by the speed at which the acquisition was performed, and made a beeline for the side of the hall. Janice looked up after a moment. Skald had chosen a seat close enough to her for conversation, but not so close as to imply intrusion. The Regolian girl immediately forced a smile and said, Oh, hi. You're Professor Ravenhair, right? Off campus, it's just Skald, Skald replied with a grin. You're Janice, right? Hannibal Hamlin II's RA.
That's me, Janice replied. It's been good this year so far. No one's too out of hand. Everything's going pretty well.
She trailed off. Skald frowned internally and tried another tack. How's the IPO business going for you? Had a chance to talk to Ben tonight?
Oh, I saw the chief earlier, Janice said. He was going over to talk to Liza Schustal. Still can't get used to that one, sorry.
Skald chuckled.
I can see why. I'm surprised you're over here by yourself, though.
I'm not very good at parties, Janice replied. And, well, IPO reserve officer, not a duelist, not from Zeta Cygni. I feel kind of out of place here.
Aha, Skald thought to herself.
Well, I'm not a social butterfly myself. I'd rather be in my workshop. But why don't we go find someone else who feels out of place and see how they're doing? The Norn asked.
Janice made a half-horrified grimace.
With my luck, they'll be doing perfectly fine without being made to take on a project, she mumbled.
A project? Skald asked, puzzled.
Someone they have to make nice to because they were told to, Janice said. I'm used to it from school back on Raggle.
Skald found herself at a momentary loss for words. Just then, Kay Morgan wandered over to say hello to Skald. She summed up the situation in a glance and took a moment to introduce herself to Janice, exchange holiday wishes, and mention that there was a young man here from Kay's own homeworld of Niogi.
Seems he couldn't get home for Christmas. Marty caught him at the IPO office in Beltane and invited him along, Kay said. He's over at the sound system, investigating it a bit too closely. Maybe I should bring him over before he tries to take it apart.
Certainly, Skald agreed, giving Kay a grateful wink when she was sure Janice wasn't looking.
Kay returned the wink and strolled across the hall to a young man, tall, burly, with brown hair and an unremarkable cut and friendly hazel eyes, in a polo shirt and khakis. She tugged on his arm, smiled, and said something Janice couldn't quite lip-read properly, even with her eye turned up to full magnification.
Must not be talking standard, she mused. What language do they speak on Niogi?
They returned in a moment, Kay looking pleased, the newcomer looking politely bemused.
Officer Janice Barlow, International Police Organization. This is Officer Neil Krummel, IPO.
Neil, this is Janice, and I'm sure you remember Skald, Kay said with a small, private smile.
Hard to forget, Neil replied, shaking Skald's hand with a smile.
Janice, hi, nice to meet you. So, what's your duty assignment?
Janice blinked, took the offered hand almost absent-mindedly, and replied,
Actually, I'm a reserve officer. I go to Mandeville Memorial on Gerardo. Chief recruited me earlier this year.
Really? Neil replied with a raised eyebrow and a grin. That must be some story. Come on, let's get a table and something to eat, and you can tell me.
The two IPO officers drifted off, Neil amiable, Janice warming to him slowly. Skald and Kay exchanged a discreet high five before going their separate ways. The duties of good hostesses were never completed. Right now, though, Skald had another duty she wanted to attend to, one which had little to do with hospitality. She scanned the crowd again, returning to her original search. When she'd been interrupted by the sight of Janice Barlow not having any fun, she'd actually been looking for... There! Wakaba Shinohara, who stood out even in this crowd in her gold-buttoned, black-and-white Otori Academy uniform. She and Sayanji, when asked by Bell if they wouldn't mind playing staff until dinner, had dusted off their old uniforms for the simple reason that they were the most formal clothes they had. Skald smiled, then intercepted the girl as she headed back toward the buffet table to load up with more canapes.
Oh, hello, Professor Ravenhair, said Wakaba. Sorry, I'm cleaned out. Marty Rose scarfed every last one of the Barjog puffs, the pig. she added, grinning. Skuld smiled. That's all right, I'm saving space for dinner anyway. Can I talk to you privately for a minute, Wakaba? Sure. Curious, Wakaba put her empty tray down on the table, then followed Skuld around a corner and into a side room that looked like some sort of den or office, small by the standards of the castle. What's on your mind? Have you heard of the Test of Light? Skuld inquired. Sure, Wakaba replied. It was in Captain Bacon's book. It's the test that the experts of justice use to screen lensmen. Why? Would you like to take it? Asked Skuld. Wakaba blinked. You don't waste time, she said appreciatively. In some matters, I don't have a lot to waste, Skuld replied. Wakaba nodded thoughtfully. Well, Sure, I'd be honored, but I'd think there'd be others more suitable than me. Skuld smiled. I've been doing this for 15 years, she said. I like to think I've gotten pretty good at knowing who's suitable. Of course, I didn't mean to imply... It's just... Wakaba stopped, realizing that she was starting to babble, shook her head, and said, Deja vu. Skuld looked a little curious. If you're what I've been told you are, said Wakaba slowly, then you probably know I'm from another world. We all are, Utina's old schoolmates. Skuld nodded. I'm a little different from the others, Wakaba went on. I was sent here on purpose. She shook her head, laughing. This is nuts, she said. A year ago I was nobody. Just another girl going to a good school. 6 months before that, my best friend was changing the world, but I was too normal to notice. I was just going through the motions. And now I'm in another world, and I'm different. Taking charge of things, rescuing my friends, fighting for justice, traveling in space. My life is everything I never thought it could be. And on top of all that, you're offering me a chance to be a lensman. If what you're trying to say is that it's too much to absorb, I understand, said Skuld. Wakaba grinned. Nah, that's not what I'm saying, she replied. I'm just saying it's a crazy world. But listen, what about my original question? I mean, if I've got what it takes to wear the lens, then what about the others? What about Utina? She was doing this kind of stuff while I was still writing stupid love letters to upperclassmen. Skuld smiled. I have my eye on several of your circle, not least Utina, she said. You're right, she has all the qualities necessary, but... She shook her head. She isn't ready yet. And I am? Wakaba blurted. Not as if she thought Skuld was lying, but as if she couldn't believe the whole concept. Skuld's smile became a grin. That's what the test is supposed to find out, she said. Well, okay then, said Wakaba. When do you want to do it? How about now? Now? Right here? Skuld shrugged. I can do it pretty much anywhere. It only takes a few minutes. Oh. Well, all right then. Good, said Skuld. Now just relax. This won't hurt. She stepped forward, placed the cool palm of her right hand on Wakaba's forehead, and closed her eyes. Light surrounded them. The mark on Skuld's forehead glowed like a beacon, emitting a glow that could almost be felt and heard as well as seen. Wakaba froze. Part of her wanted to panic, and the rest thought that the light was the most soothing thing she'd ever seen. It was like the light that had surrounded her when Clef had made her a gift of magic, whatever that had meant. Then it was over, and Skuld opened her eyes. Well, said Wakaba, her voice quieter. Skuld grinned at her. Quite remarkable, she said. Then the Norn of Tomorrow stepped back a few feet and closed her eyes again, holding her hands in front of her, palms facing each other and about 6 inches apart.
The mark on her forehead glowed again, still brighter this time, and light began to gather between her hands, rays of it streaking together to add to the brilliance suspended there. She began to murmur in a language Wakaba didn't recognize. Between Skold's hands, the light began to shift, changing color, shifting from white to yellow, and then rising up the spectrum to a brilliant violet before falling back to a bright, clear green. Then a beam leapt from the corona of light to strike Wakaba squarely in the forehead. She went rigid with surprise, but didn't cry out or topple. She merely stood transfixed while the beam played over her forehead for several seconds. Then the beam snapped off, the glow faded, and Skold opened her eyes and smiled. Wakaba gasped at the sight of the small object that floated between Skold's still separated hands. It was a jewel, round and lenticular, about an inch and a half across, and a rather dull green. It floated between her hands, turning slowly, glittering in the light of the hollow torches. Wakaba's eyes gleamed, reflecting it. "Well, go on," said Skold. "Take it." Wakaba reached tentatively out and closed her hand around the gem. The instant her skin touched it, it flared into brilliant life, emerald light raying out from between her fingers to play over her and Skold, and vanished. She gasped again, jerking her hand back, but the stone was gone. She turned her hand over, then looked at the other, and there it was, clasped around her left wrist by a silvery metallic band, just like a wristwatch, but glowing softly. Skold grinned. "Success!" she announced. She grinned her broadest grin yet, then came to attention and saluted, saying, "Congratulations, Lensman Shinohara." "Does this mean I'm an expert now?" Wakaba wondered, mentally chiding herself for not finding this out before agreeing to the procedure. Skold shrugged. "It does if you want to be. Any lensman can join the IPO, though not all of them have. Some are what we call gray lensmen, free agents, not assigned to any particular group or station. That's Ben's call to make, but given your special circumstances and all that you've already been through, I'd be surprised if he didn't make you gray." Skold clapped her hands together then, becoming brisk and cheery, and announced, "Now listen up, lensman. This is the only orientation you get, so pay attention." Wakaba grinned. "Yes, ma'am," she said. "Just Skold is fine when school's out." "Okay, listen. That lens is yours and yours alone. It's part of you. It can't be removed except by you. Well, barring amputation." Wakaba glanced at her wrist and shrugged. "When it's glowing," Skold went on, "it's safe. It's with you, it's happy. If it's not touching you, it goes dark. If anybody but you touches it while it's dark, it'll hurt them. If they touch it for more than a second or two, it'll kill them. So be careful and don't leave it lying around." "Important safety tip," said Wakaba appreciatively. "Okay, that's the hard part. The rest of it's simple. The lens has certain innate abilities. They vary slightly from person to person. You'll need to discover what special abilities yours may have for yourself, but they all have a few things in common. They all act as psi barriers, powerful ones. No psi cop will ever be able to mess with your mind now that you've got your lens. If they try too hard, they'll hurt themselves, badly. The lens will throw back at them double whatever they throw at it. They're all telepathic communicators, too. By concentrating, you can make surface mind-to-mind contact with any other lensman, anywhere in the universe, instantly. With practice, you can even contact non-lensmen, or more than one person at a time, sort of a telepathic conference call. The conversations you have that way are secure. Nobody, and I mean absolutely nobody, can hear them except you and whoever you called. The lens also sends out a low-level telepathic signal to any sentient life form that can see it, identifying you as a lensman. That way, the lens can't be counterfeited, and neither can you. You have Wakaba Shinohara's lens, you have to be Wakaba Shinohara. There's no way around it. You can stop it from doing that, though, if you're trying to be inconspicuous. That's it for the basic stuff.
Like I said, all lenses are unique, yours more so than most, and they all have special abilities that depend largely on the owner. You'll discover yours with time, as you and the lens get used to each other. Don't be afraid to experiment. Any questions? Wakaba mused. What happens if I die? Does the lens lie around, killing anybody who tries to pick it up for the rest of time? No. If you die, your lens will no longer have any reason to exist. It'll disintegrate within a few minutes. Oh, well, that's good. I guess that's it. Are you sure? You don't look convinced. Well, Wakaba shrugged. I figured there'd be an oath or something, promising not to use the lens for evil, that kind of thing. In brightest day and blackest night, that kind of thing? Yeah, something like that. Skuld smiled. No oath necessary. Assuming I misjudged you before I made the lens for you in the first place, if you were the kind of person who would misuse the power of the lens, or your own power, come to that, it wouldn't have accepted you as its wearer. You'd be lying there dead on the rug. That's why the integrity of lensmen is so readily accepted around the universe, because anybody with an education knows that a lensman wouldn't be a lensman if he weren't worthy of his lens. Wakaba blinked. Gosh, she said wryly. Thanks for mentioning that up front. Has that ever happened? Only once, Skuld replied with a touch of sadness in her eyes. Oh, said Wakaba. Her demeanor softened, sobering a bit from her smiling flippancy, as all she'd just been told started to sink into her brain. She looked again at the lens, then at its maker. That's... wow. I don't know what to say. You don't have to say anything, Skuld replied with a smile. Just do your best. It's all I ask of you. It's all the lens will ask of you. Do your best. Wakaba gazed into the shifting light of her lens for another few moments, then let the sleeve of her black uniform jacket fall and grinned at Skuld once more. I always do, she said. Skuld clapped her on the shoulder. Good. Well, congratulations again. I guess I'll let you get back to work before my sister wonders what's become of you. Wakaba smiled and followed the Norn out of the room, back into the great hall. There, Skuld vanished into the crowd again, and Wakaba returned to the buffet table to complete her interrupted errand. Sionji was there too, getting more drinks. He gave her a curious look as she approached. What was that all about? He asked her in a low voice. Wakaba leaned toward him, stretched up to kiss him on the cheek, and murmured with a sly smile, Oh, stuff. I'll show you later. That horse Derver used to be somebody's mommy. Utina took a sudden, horrified look at the sausage impaled on the toothpick in her hand. Reassured that it was still pork and not something entirely other, she looked for the source of the bright, high-pitched voice that had given her the scare. Looking down, she noticed a little girl, perhaps 5 years old or so, looking back at her with big lavender eyes. Utina had never thought that she'd ever meet a person with hair of a more peculiar shade of pink than her own, but this little girl's hair shaded almost to transparent white at the ends. Where Utina's mane was a bright splash of color that made her stand out some distance away, this girl's scalp was like a pastel explosion, cropped short except for one lock of hair held together by a rubber band on one side of her head. That's a very unusual thing to say to someone you just met, Utina said diplomatically. Still true, the girl replied. I'm Wapiko. What's your name? I'm Utina. Nice to meet you. Now things dropped into place. Once or twice, Kate and Corwin had related horror stories about babysitting a little pink-haired dynamo for the Overstreet family. Utina had thought the stories exaggeration at the time. After all, no little girl could ever be that destructive, not even a Hoffmanite girl wearing a rocket pack. That's a nice name. Wapiko said, smiling so cheerfully that Utena couldn't help smiling herself.
Would you like me to get you something different to eat?
Wakaba pointed at the sausage and made a face.
Sure,
Utena said. Could you do that for me?
No problem. Wait here.
Wapiko! With one foot raised to step off, Wapiko froze in place. A man of medium height, his blonde red hair and red beard bristling every which way, stepped over to the two of them and said, "Remember, you walk here, no running. Right?"
"Yes, Daddy,"
Wapiko nodded obediently. "And what else did I tell you?"
"Always open doors afore you go through 'em,"
Wapiko quoted. "Very good. Now go along," the man said, and as Wapiko walked briskly off toward the serving tables, he turned to Utena and said, "I'm sorry if she was bothering you, miss."
No, that's quite all right, Mr. Overstreet."
"That's me," the redneck nodded, "and I'm already told that you're Caitlin's roommate, Utena." "Enchanté," he smiled, bowing deeply to her. "I'll be having a barbecue in March, and I've asked Kate if her band would provide some music. Could you maybe put in a..." A figure shimmered from thin air into hard reality over the redneck's shoulder.
"Hey, stepdad," she said.
She was a long, full-figured woman with cyan-tinted hair floating on her side in mid-air, a curious position to adopt, certainly, but it seemed comfortable.
"Ryoko, I told you, don't call me that," the redneck grumbled. "Thought you might like to look over by the buffet," she said. Looking over to Utena, she added, "Hey, kid, nice duds. You look like an Atlantean fighter pilot at a funeral."
"Oh, no," the redneck groaned, as he saw one of the most heavily laden buffet tables rise about a foot in the air, turn 90 degrees, and begin bouncing its way toward them.
"Did Wapiko offer to bring you something?"
"Yes, you mean..." The heavy timber table had to weigh 50 pounds empty, and the food piled on top at least 100 pounds more, and it was pushing slowly through the crowd towards her, carried aloft by a 5-year-old girl.
"Wapiko!"
"I beg your pardon, Utena, really sorry," the redneck muttered as he walked out to meet the table midway.
"Wapiko, how many times do I have to tell you? If someone asks you to bring them a snack, use a plate."
"But I don't know what she wants," a voice said from under the table.
"And Ma wonders why we don't get invited to parties," Ryoko giggled. "Ah, well. Later, kiddo."
Smirking, Ryoko floated up toward the ceiling, fading out well before reaching the crossbeams. Utena stared up for a moment, then watched the redneck herding the buffet table back to its proper spot, and thought that she ought to know better by now than to doubt anything Corbin or Kate told her, no matter how outlandish.